This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Coming up next, conversations on human rights with Speak Up, Kōrero Tia, here on Plains FM.
E nā mana, e nā reo, e nā hō e whā. Tēnā koutou katoa. No mai ki tēne hōtaka. Speak Up, Kōrero Tia. Tune in as our guests Speak Up, sharing their unique and powerful experiences and opinions. And may you also be inspired to speak up when the moment's right. Nau mai, haere mai, welcome to Speak Up, Kōrero Tia. I'm your host, Sally Carlton, and today we're talking about cyberbullying. We have three guests. Sean Lyons, Director of Outreach from NetSafe. Thanks, Sean, for joining us from Auckland on the phone.
My pleasure.
George Guild, who's a lecturer at ARA University, or ARA Tertiary Service?
ARA Institute.
Sorry.
ARA no
Institute
worries.
Next door, which is pretty handy. You're right next door. It's cool. And Nikki Wheeler, who's one of the founding members of Sticks and Stones Cyberbullying Group. So I'm really looking forward to hearing a little bit more about the background of each of you and what you think you'll be bringing to this conversation. Sean, perhaps we'll start with you.
Sure. So in terms of my background, I come from a background in both the IT industry and education. I was a teacher for a number of years, a high school teacher for a number of years. Obviously, NetSafe, the one thing, I guess, when you speak to someone who has heard of NetSafe, the first thing they'll probably say is that they're the cyberbullying people. And that's not to say we do any cyberbullying. Hopefully we don't. But in terms of that has been, if you like, a great deal of NetSafe's bread and butter and a big part of the reason that NetSafe existed. So it's certainly something that we as an organization are interested in, that I am personally interested in. And look, I love talking about this kind of stuff. It's great to hear other people's opinions and points of view, and really appreciate the chance to discuss it today.
Sean, just something that struck me when you were talking then. You mentioned you were a teacher. Is that one of the reasons that you got involved in this cyberbullying space? Was that sort of a personal experience thing?
Yeah, I mean, it was. And I wouldn't want to overstate it too much in terms of the reason that I'm here. But there were, towards the end of my teaching career, I was very much aware and directly involved in a number of incidents, often disciplinary incidents, in terms of what I was, my roles within schools, that had increasingly cyber elements to them, and that was both interesting and challenging at the time when within a school environment where we were trying very hard to capture the enthusiasm that young people had for online technologies and think about ways in which we could harness that enthusiasm, which was very much the conversation that went on in education at the time, harnessing that enthusiasm and that natural desire to learn that we were seeing, motivated by students as individuals outside of school, and saying how can we grab this and utilize it in terms of the more formal education, but at the same time then wrestling with the increasing numbers of online related discipline issues. But yeah, I mean, so very much that became a big part of what I was doing in my role as an educator, and then so it became a kind of logical extension to carry on doing that with an organisation like NetSafe.
Interesting. I can see both our guests here nodding away. Nikki, how about we hear from you?
So basically, my experience in cyberbullying started when I joined Sticks and Stones, which is a group of young people who are promoting positive life online and just trying to create a positive change in our community. We started down in Central Otago back in 2013. Back then I was just a member, and we were doing all these sorts of cool things to just create a bit of positivity. We just saw there was a need for a bit of change because there was such a negative culture online, definitely in our community. Being such a small community, I think that possibly magnified the issue a little bit. Now I have moved to Christchurch. I'm studying to be a primary teacher at the University of Canterbury. I've sort of taken a step back from the group, and I've become more of a mentor to the other members who are coming up through the ranks. And I'm also a member on the, I'm a secretary on the Board of Trustees. So that's where I come in. Yeah.
And Sticks and Stones has just won some award. Or you won the award.
Yeah, I just won, it's called the Giving Back Award through the Ministry of Youth Development, just for my work through Sticks and Stones. Yeah.
Very cool. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Well done. I like the name.
Yeah, it took us months and months to come up with the name.
Did it? My goodness.
Yeah, that was one of our first big hurdles that we came over, was trying to figure out the name and a logo and our brand and all that sort of thing. Yeah.
Never was a saying so wrong.
Yeah.
Well, particularly when we're talking about cyberbullying.
Exactly, yeah.
And George?
Kia ora. So I'm a social worker with a approximate 10-year background working with adolescents. In the areas of mental health, youth justice and addictions. And I guess during that time I saw loads of young people who were coming to our services due to stress because of incidents that had happened online. And I guess we were seeing increasing incidents of this and cases of young people coming to us, bullying, just not stopping. Yeah, back in my day, it would stop at the school gate, but it just doesn't stop anymore. And so we saw a lot of that, as well as sharing of quite kind of telling pictures and videos of students as well being shared around. We saw these incidents as being increasingly common in my work. And now I find myself teaching social work next door at ARA Institute, formerly CPIT. And I guess in terms of cyberbullying and the Harmful Digital Communications Act, we had some connection with this material last year via two kind of ways. The first way was that our Year 2's social policy class looked at cyberbullying as a social issue. And then we also looked at the different ways it can be addressed. So, and the Harmful Digital Communications Act was one of those ways. I also taught some young people through Canterbury Tertiary College at ARDA, and they were sort of 16 to 18, and they would come to ARDA on a Thursday and Friday. And one of the unit standards was about how a law goes through Parliament, and we looked at the Harmful Digital Communications Act. And the young people had quite a bit to say about the issue of cyberbullying.
I bet.
Yeah.
Well, this might be a good point then to talk about what is that Harmful Digital Communications Act, when was it introduced, and Sean to talk about NetSafe and its role therein as well.
Sure. So, the Act, July 2015, I think, was the passing into Parliament. So, and some parts of it became active immediately around that. But it's been a long time in the making in the run up to that. So, we probably saw 3 or 4 years of the legal review process in the run up to it, and then it's processed through Parliament and the various the lobbying backwards and forwards before it was passed in to become law. So it was a rocky road in terms of its passage in. There were times where it looked like it maybe wouldn't survive, and then even sort of last minute dramatic crossing of the house, I think it is the phrase where political parties had said they would back it and then didn't. So it was, I mean, maybe from my perspective, I'm probably building up the drama here. It was quite dramatic for us. I'm not so sure that it's the first time I've watched Parliament TV. That's for certain. But here we are now, 2017, on from that Act. NetSafe, once the Act was passed, NetSafe had to express an interest and then compete, if you like, for one of the parts of that law, which was for the establishment of what's defined in the law as an approved agency to take complaints under the Harmful Digital Communications Act. So we were got that secured in at the beginning of 2016, and by November the 21st, NetSafe opened its doors as the approved agency, and we've been functioning in that role ever since.
Do you have a sense of how many complaints you've been receiving in the few months since you've been doing this role?
Yeah, so a good estimate would be somewhere just short of 400 personal harm complaints per month. So just to give some context, NetSafe has been operating a helpline for various issues around online safety since about 2003. So, and those functions continue. NetSafe still is NetSafe, and it still addresses a whole range of online safety issues for anybody in New Zealand. But the increase in the numbers around specifically around personal harm are approximately somewhere in that mid 300s to 400 per month range. So that's quite a jump for us in terms of the number of conversations that we're having about harm. It's always been in and around about 10% of the calls that we have taken, but those percentages will now will jump and skew partly because of the agency function that we have, but also just partly because I think that the fact that we now have legislation that says you don't just have to accept it because it's online, you don't just have to put up with it, that there are there have been sort of legal lines drawn in the sand around what is and isn't acceptable behavior online. It now means that people have, a yardstick to draw that against, and if they feel like they have been harmed, then they have somewhere to go to talk about that.
Just quickly then, to finish off this section, what is cyberbullying, and is there a difference, do we think, between how it's being defined in the Act versus how people tend to perceive of it?
Look, from my perspective, absolutely. Even the fact that the Harmful Digital Communications Bill is commonly referred to as the Cyberbullying Bill or the Cyberbullying Act kind of talks to what people's perception of these kind of events are about. So the premise of the Act is that nobody should have to put up with any harm online, that a single action that causes an individual serious emotional distress, we shouldn't have to do that, and there should be people should be able to seek redress of some description if they are harmed by content online. So bullying, as probably as we all understand it, or as the popular understanding of bullying is probably much as we have always imagined it, much as we've always seen it portrayed in the media, that the idea that bullying is an action that goes on between two people, that it happens repeatedly, that there is harm to an individual, and that there is some kind of power imbalance between the two individuals. So, I mean, that talks to the sort of classic Tom and Jerry kind of assault. So you've got somebody who in theory is more powerful, and they pick on somebody who's less powerful. That's the idea of bullying effectively. Cyberbullying then is the online component of that. But this Act is not looking for necessarily looking for patterns of behaviour that indicate bullying. What it is looking for is to assess whether or not somebody, like I say, has been harmed, and if they have been harmed, then provide them with in the first instance some civil redress, and if needs be redress through the courts, and in particularly egregious situations then criminal redress via the police.
I just think that often when you hear cyberbullying, people might think, oh, that's cyberbullying, that's not. But like Sean's saying, it's if it actually causes harm, then it's still important to address it, not necessarily put a label on what it actually is. Yeah, that's what I would say about that. And also I think it's important to remember that cyberbullying doesn't usually happen in isolation. There's usually something else going on outside, whether that's verbal, emotional, physical bullying. It's very uncommon to have cyberbullying happen in isolation.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we'll just finish off this part with, Nikki, your choice of song.
Okay.
Was there a reason why you picked it?
I went through a bit of a tough time during high school, and this was sort of like the anthem to my life, like just to pick me up when I was feeling a bit down, so yeah.
Well, that sounds very appropriate for today then.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got Fight Song by Rachel Platten.
Like a small boat on the ocean, sending big waves into motion, like how a single word can make a heart open. I might only have one match, but I can make an explosion. And all those things I didn't say were wrecking balls inside my brain. I will scream loud tonight. Can you hear my voice this time? This is my fight song. Take back my life song. Prove I'm alright song. My power's turned on.
Starting right now.
I'll be strong. I'll play my fight song. And I don't really care if nobody else believes. Cause I've still got a lot of fight left in me. Losing friends and I'm chasing sleep. Everybody's worried about me. In too deep. I say I'm in too deep.
In too deep.
And it's been 2 years, I miss my home. But there's fire burning in my bones. Still believe. Yeah, I still believe.
Speak Up Cordero Tia here on Plains FM 96.9. I'm your host, Sally Carlton, and we're talking with Sean Lyons, George Guild, and Nikki Wheeler about cyberbullying. Sean, you ended up talking about the fact NetSafe is receiving 400-ish complaints a month around cyberbullying. Do we have a sense of the scope or the scale of the issue in New Zealand? I mean, rather than just the complaints coming through NetSafe, are there any other stats being collected?
Yeah, I mean, there are a number of stats, and I'm sure Nikki may want to talk about the sticks and stones surveys they've done over the years. But look, generically speaking, we've seen a number of figures that put it somewhere roughly around one in five young people will experience cyberbullying in the previous 12 months. And also some research done by the Ministry of Justice suggests that the adult numbers there would be about one in 10. So, you know, and those numbers kind of stack up against a number of other territories that we keep a watch on. So European countries, countries in the US, OECD numbers, that would put us, you know, pretty much in the same league as a number of those other countries. So we are fairly confident that those are indicative numbers for New Zealand.
Yeah, I think it changes from region to region, though. Like, I know with the Sticks and Stones, we conducted a survey across the five secondary schools in the region, and we found that one in three had been bullied in some form. But I think, yeah, generally across the nation, it's about one in five, so yeah.
Did you gather any data as to why it might be different for
yes,
certain schools?
I just can't remember it off the top of my head. I have it on my laptop, but yeah. Sorry.
That's all right.
I've also got some information, and we looked at this in our social policy class around the discourse around cyberbullying, in that it's often perceived as a young person's problem, but happens to a lot of adults as well.
Which I think is not really A, known about or B, discussed.
I think
that when people think cyberbullying, they often go, oh, that's the teenagers, because they're all on their phones, they're all on their laptops all the time, and there's definitely that stigma around, oh, you're a teenager, you're exposed to cyberbullying or bullying in some form. But I think it's really important to remember that definitely even with adults, I think if you get really fired up about something, or if it's really you're really emotionally charged by something, often the internet can be a good place to let that go, because you can be anonymous, or you become this other person when you're on the internet. It's not like you're saying it to someone's face. So I think that's where that sort of comes in.
I mean, I think it's also very difficult for because of the word, and, you know, not to jump on semantics, but because of the word bullying and the connotations that everybody has, or the perceptions everybody has when it comes to bullying, it's very hard for, you know, a grown adult in theory to say, I am being bullied. We might call it a number of other things, but the truth of it is, but by the definition that there are, and we see, you know, quite a number of adults, in fact, more adults than young people, tend to report these kind of behaviours to us. Very loath, like I say, to call it bullying, but when it comes down to it, in terms of the degree of distress and, you know, often in terms of how determined the perpetrators are, this is happening to an increasing number of adults, and the harm can be quite significant.
It's really interesting, the idea of people coming forward. I mean, you've got to report it, don't you, to classify it yourself as being harmful.
I think that it's really hard to, if you're admitting it to someone else, you're admitting it to yourself, and you're going, yes, this is actually hurting me, and it's sort of a hard thing to be able to speak up about. Yeah. Especially if you're feeling quite isolated and alone. Like, when there was the anonymous platform, I know, like, at high school, AskFM was a big deal. Yes. Everyone knows about AskFM. It's sort of, I don't think it's as big a deal as it used to be, but people would often feel very alone and very isolated, and think that because there was all these messages coming through, it would be everyone thought the same thing, when it would have just been one person. So I think that them going, hey, asking for help from someone would be really difficult, because they're like, oh, what if you think the same? So, yeah.
As well as age, and we've spoken quite a lot around teenagers and adults, do we have any sense of whether people who are being bullied, or at least people who are reporting cyberbullying, if those stats can be broken down by other demographics? I'm thinking sex, for example, ethnicity, perhaps. Do you know if those sorts of breakdowns are recorded?
To some extent, we do record details for where people choose to provide them. So, obviously, as an organisation, we don't. It's not compulsory to report to us any of those demographic information, or any of that demographic information associated with a report of harm. But some people do. And to be honest with you, the numbers probably aren't, because of the number that do versus don't report, are probably not statistically significant. But what we have seen over time, certainly in terms of gender, then there's never been particularly any sway one way or the other. Now, you can walk into a particular environment. In the past, I've worked with girls' schools who have felt that their problems were particularly great by comparison to co-ed or to boys' schools, but the numbers don't quite stack up. There have been, you know, that there is some evidence that there are groups that may be more likely to suffer at the hands of cyber bullies, but like I say, probably not statistically significant enough to say it's a problem for this group and it's not a problem for that group. The truth is that, unfortunately, from what we can see, the those that are harmed by other people in online communications are a fairly good representation of the general population. So it's not like we can particularly say, right, well, if we could just deal with a particular age and a particular ethnic background, we'd be fine, because the truth is it affects most people in whatever capacity we are. Sorry, not most people, but most types of people, no matter who they are.
Yeah, I agree. I have some statistics here. There was a New Zealand Attitudes and Values study, I think undertaken last year, and it reported that females in the age bracket of 18 to 19 self-reported the highest amount of cyberbullying. But I remember in social policy when we were looking at this, there was a clip on one of the morning news shows that actually reported that men also reported quite a high level of bullying, and some of the content about what they were bullied about was a little bit different. I think there was a tendency for females sometimes to receive a higher content of sexualized kind of bullying, and the men's bullying was about their identity, their masculinity, or violence, threats of violence. And lots of work I did in London with young men in the youth offending arena had received all sorts of online bullying and threats of violence. Yeah.
Interesting, isn't it? Because that's, I guess, it's talking about physical violence,
yeah,
but through the medium of the internet.
I mean, I think what that says, I mean, something that I think we've probably all known for a long time, that there's not something entirely exceptional about cyberbullying, and I mean, you use that advisedly, that there's not, people don't pick something new and do something quite separate in terms of cyberbullying, and like you said before, that the idea of isolated cyberbullying increasingly is being understood as a nonsense. You know, what we're seeing is similar kind of social challenge that goes on physically, that is being represented on communication mediums that young people and adults are using anyway. So, you know, when we talk about increasing amounts of cyberbullying, what we're probably really talking about is the increasing display of traditional harmful behaviours being displayed online, rather than new behaviours taking place online.
That's really interesting to know. I also wonder if potentially people are more aware of it and more aware that there is an avenue of recourse, potentially, so that maybe they're reporting it more. Is that what you were getting at, Sean?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think partially. I mean, unfortunately, there's also a... there's increasingly, I wonder how long it would take me to have a bash at the media, but there we go. Here I am. There's an increasing penchant, unfortunately, for media outlets to sensationalise online harassment, to sensationalise cyberbullying, and talk about it in isolation as, you know, a pariah that needs to be stamped out or dealt with, and which, you know, on one hand, you know, to some extent has led to the establishment of a new law in New Zealand, and I think eventually we'll all be grateful for that. But what it's kind of skipped over the opportunity to do is to kind of widen that conversation around, is this now just giving us a window into problematic behaviours amongst all sorts of people, not just young people, but in terms of the way that we are dealing with each other and into the way that conflict is going on. But yeah, we're seeing an increased report, we're seeing an increased media coverage, and that may well be giving us a slightly distorted view of what's going on.
Very probable. Okay, we'll just end this segment with George's choice of song, which is High and Dry by Radiohead. Any particular reason, or you just love it?
It's like it's my favourite song in the world, but I was thinking it's over 20 years old now, and I guess I really loved listening to it when I was in my late teens, which isn't the easiest period of life. So love this song, it gives me great comfort.
Speak Up Kōrero Tia on Plains FM 96.9, and we're talking today about cyberbullying. We've just been talking about the incidences of cyberbullying in New Zealand, and we thought we might get on to talking about what actually is it? What are some examples? George, you touched on before people being threatened physically. You also touched on sexualized representations, those sorts of things. But some kind of case studies would, I think, be very helpful in terms of clarifying for our listeners exactly what it is, because it's kind of this big amorphous concept in many ways.
Sure, I could give you a few case studies, but one that comes to mind was a young person I was working with in London, actually, and she was referred to the mental health service I was working with at the time because she wouldn't go to school. And actually it emerged that someone had taken a video clip of her, some footage of her performing a sexual act, without her knowledge, and then distributed that all around the borough, so the local area. So she didn't want to go to schools in that area. She was quite happy to go to schools outside of it, but the borough wouldn't place her outside. So that was one really clear case of cyberbullying, and I used to sort of walk around with her in the community, and we had to change direction several times because she would know somebody who had seen it. And it caused her a lot of embarrassment, and she wasn't able to go to school.
Awful. Yeah.
I'll just talk quickly about my own experience of what happened. And basically, what I experienced was one girl who was just really awful to me in lots of different platforms. So it started off just text, like we were really good friends, and then the relationship sort of turned a bit nasty. So it started off with just text, and then and then eventually it was messages on Facebook, and then I was getting people sending me screenshots of messages she'd sent them, just saying, spreading awful things. And I think, I don't really know what else to say about that, but that's just one of the things. It was just on several different platforms that she was saying really awful things, and yeah.
And sorry, Nikki, can I ask, because there was a case in Australia where at a school, somebody posted something up on a class page, a Facebook group page, and other people from the schools liked it. Did anyone else like it? Or
It was more, it wasn't necessarily a post on Facebook, it was just within the friend group, so it sort of made me feel quite isolated. And I think what happened with that was I never like stopped going to school. I was really lucky, I had the support of my parents and the school. I never stopped going to school, but when I went to school, it was isolating because people had read the things and then they were like, oh, well, we don't want to be friends with her because we don't want to be the victims ourselves. So it's sort of the full circle as well. So it's online and then you get to school and people don't want to associate themselves to you because they don't want to become the victims themselves. Mm-hmm. So I think that's, again, where the bystander comes in. So it's really important if you're seeing these behaviours happening to just jump in and offer some support, because the more people you have to support you behind it, the less likely they are to continue the act. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I guess something that's occurred to me listening to both your stories there is that cyberbullying can be that one-on-one if it was just between you and this girl.
Yeah.
But I guess maybe even the point of it is it becomes bigger than that, and more and more people, the point is to embarrass or shame or...
And I don't even think necessarily if it didn't become bigger than that, but because of the internet, it can seem a lot bigger than it is. Yeah.
I definitely agree with that. I mean, the one of the sort of unique things, I guess, about cyberbullying as compared to, you know, it's often referred to traditional bullying, is the idea of both scale and scope. And exactly as you say, that you don't have to see 145,000 likes to feel the pressure of that number of people in support of the perpetrator and you know, turning their back on you. That often the fact that it's there, it's potentially visible, it's been up already for X number of days before you were made aware of it. All of those kind of factors, let's say even the perception of those things are part of the compound problem when this stuff's shared electronically, as opposed to maybe just, you know, whispered behind your back or passed around on a piece of paper inside a classroom. Mm-hmm.
I think something really interesting about cyberbullying that's always struck me is that you could be cyberbullied without necessarily have someone cyberbullying you. So say there's an image shared or something like that. So it could be shared 147 times, for example. The person who's passed it on and keeps passing it on aren't necessarily cyberbullying you. It's just a one-off incident, but you are being cyberbullied because it's happened so many times. So I think that's an interesting, another side of cyberbullying. So it's just so difficult because cyberbullying is just this huge, broad spectrum of what could, anything that could happen. So, yeah.
I think as well with that, you don't have to know the person of, you know, the pictures of that person. You don't have to know them. You can still just share it and not actually target anyone deliberately. Yeah. But in sharing it, you are nonetheless.
Or even liking something on Facebook, like you were talking about before. Even if you're liking it, you're not cyberbullying the person, but they are being cyberbullied due to the effect that it's having on them.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Mm. Does that make it difficult, Sean, in terms of people's complaints and how to actually get some redress for them?
In terms of the numbers of people following or watching it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that there's... The idea... that effectively, you know, the bystander component to any bullying situation is obviously hugely important. When you extend that online and to say that someone has positively liked something that was you know, clearly and openly detrimental to an individual, I mean, you could say that, you know, that's someone who has kind of joined in. But, you know, when the bullying is, or the messaging is subtle, you know, when you take, let's say you take a meme where you put a picture up and you address an issue without naming somebody, but everybody within a particular social circle understands that it's actually pointed at a particular person, the image itself contains nothing that directly links to the person, but let's face it, you know, this is a networked public amongst a small group. Everybody knows who it's pointed at. But then you say, well, you've all followed it, you've all liked it, therefore you're responsible, you're partly responsible. You then get that in a situation where people could quite easily, plausibly deny and say, well, as far as I'm concerned, it's just an image. It doesn't name anybody. It doesn't. I'm not really involved. I was just. So, you know, there are a whole lot of difficulties. But in saying that, you know, the idea that people can be, and people will take great lengths to make themselves anonymous around that. But part of the need for us to have a legislation around this kind of thing is that some of that that pseudo anonymity needs to be, where there is clear and obvious intent to cause harm, that you know, people's attempt to hide who they are, you know, that shouldn't be a defense for them. We need to have the ability to say, in certain circumstances, you know, this is not on. This person has done this. They've clearly harmed that individual. So now we need to go about a process of working out who that was, actually who it was, and taking some action against them as a producer of this content, rather than just sort of, you know, guesswork or trying to blame a group for the activity of one person.
Something that interests me, and this is because it tends to come up in not just cyberbullying, but in media and other avenues as well, is the idea of what can you say and it still be freedom of speech, freedom of expression. Are there any, lines laid out in the Act around as soon as it's causing harm, but then if it wasn't deliberately causing harm, but if someone takes offence to it, you can say something and it not necessarily deliberately be offensive, but nonetheless can be.
Mm.
Or different people read things different ways. There's a lot of subtlety, I think, in there. Anyway, just any thoughts on that would be really interesting.
Well, I mean, in terms of the way that the Act is laid out, I mean, that there are sort of, you know, the classic reasonable person tests within it. There are a number of communication principles that have to be breached in the first instance. So is somebody deliberately, deliberately creating false information? Are they lying about somebody? Are they encouraging other people to harm an individual? So that there are certain types of communications that are harmful. But then there is the test that says, is this person actually seriously emotionally distressed? Has this actually caused harm? So first of all, has it breached the communication principles, these kind of rules of what is and isn't okay? But on top of that, is there actual demonstrable harm here? And that's for the, you know, that's for the court to decide should those actions get that far. And then on top of that, in terms of a court ruling around these things, then there are certain factors that can be taken into account. So, I mean, which can be things like what is the age of the producer of the content and or the target of the harmful communication, but also, you know, despite the potential harm and despite the breach of the principles, is it in the public interest for this to have been said despite those things? So, you know, there's protection around humour and satire. There's protection around, you know, the idea of whistleblowers, if you like. So, you know, if you're a corrupt politician, and I use those because that's an outlandish example, because we all know in New Zealand we don't have any of those. So if you are a corrupt politician and somebody exposes something that you've done, you can't use the Harmful Digital Communications Act as a lever to silence that individual who is exposing what you've done, because it's in the common good that a corrupt public official be exposed. It can't be used to censor. You know, people can't decide that they don't like what you're saying because they have an opposing political view, and then use this act in theory as a lever to say, well, I'll have your ability to talk freely closed down. So that there are, and all rulings, all actions under this act have to take into account the New Zealand Bill of Rights Act. So in theory, that there are protections around freedom of expression and then those other things. But I think that the thing to remember, the thing that sticks with me, and I wish I could remember who first said it in the course of the work around this, was that, you know, freedom of expression is a right, but it doesn't trump all the other rights that an individual has. We have a right not to be harmed in our daily dealings, both walking down the street and online. So we can't just wave a freedom of expression banner whilst we're destroying people's spirits and say, well, look, you know, freedom of speech, I'm allowed to say it. We need to have some empathy, but we also need to understand that we just can't go around saying everything we want just because we feel like saying it, if we're directing that at other people and if what we're saying is likely to cause that person significant harm.
Mm. Very well said.
Mm.
Okay, well, just to finish off then this section, we've got your choice of song, Sean, which was R.E.M. Everybody Hurts, in fact, which is very appropriate.
Yeah, so, I mean, look, the idea, really, I mean, this is it is a song I like, and it's a song, again, reminds me, like you said, George, of just how old I actually am. But you know, the idea often, and like we said before, the idea of the cyberbullying act, when people immediately think of a certain group of the population, these issues affect us all, and also fixing these issues requires us all to have some empathy for everybody else around us. So that's why we picked the song.
When your day is long.
Speak Up Cordero Tia, and we're talking about cyberbullying. For this final segment, we're going to think about what can individuals do if they feel they're being victimised, or in the case of parents, if they feel their children or their people they're looking after, teachers maybe, students, are being cyberbullied. What might be some avenues of recourse that they could follow through with?
I'll jump in here. I think that the most important thing to do if you are a victim or you feel like you are being cyberbullied or anything negative online, it doesn't necessarily have to be as huge as cyberbullying could be, even if it's just a negative comment, just talk to someone about it. It's really important just to share that emotional load. I think when you talk to someone about it, it's really important because you are saying how you feel, and it may just... What do they say? Is a problem shared is a problem halved? You know, I just think that's really important, and that's encompasses what it means to talk to someone when you are having an issue. And then you can take the time to talk with that person and really formulate a plan about where what you want to do next, who you want to inform next, and just so you're not struggling under the weight of it all by yourself. Yeah.
I absolutely agree. I mean, I think the too often, certainly here at NetSafe, we talk to people who have left things a long time, that have that have assumed it would go away and have watched it getting worse and worse. You know, certainly from a technological perspective, the speed at which you can get help, certainly around content specifically, so the speed at which you can get things removed or blocked or taken down from the platforms that they exist, the quicker, I guess, that sort of acute feeling of harm disappears, and the less likely you are to feel that kind of infinite spread. So I think the certainly the faster you can talk to people, but also to so that somebody else can give you can give you some of that perspective where you may be feeling like things are snowballing. It might help to talk to people to kind of just to kind of get a mental check as to where it's actually at, as opposed to where you perceive it's at.
I completely agree with Nikki and Sean about talking to someone about it. And there's also a range of, I guess, technological things you can do that I'm not 100% au fait with, like blocking and stopping following, all those sorts of things. And sometimes, I guess, stepping away from the device for a wee bit, turning it off for a bit, which is a hard thing to say sometimes to young people, but stepping away from that, and adults, actually.
Yeah, I think that's often... sorry. I think that's something that parents often... It can be hard for young people to talk to their parents about it because they're scared that their parents will go, right, I'm taking your phone, I'm taking your laptop, I'm taking this, I'm taking that, because they think that that'll make it go away. It doesn't, and it can make it worse, if anything, because you... I know that I think if my phone or laptop got taken away, I'd just keep running through different things in my head about what could they be saying about me now. Because sometimes it's better to know than to not know. I'd prefer to see what people are saying about me than not see it. So I think that's a really interesting debate about, whether you should just turn your phone off for a bit or not. Yeah, I think it's different people.
Well, I think there's the blocking of things. And also, I completely agree with you. I've worked with young people whose parents have taken their phones away. Yeah. And actually the social media phones, electronic devices, are also a great source of support for young people as well.
And it can be more isolating if you don't have it than if you did have it and see the negative comments and have the positive, like with your friend chat or something like that.
But I guess there's overlooking at it as well. There was the case, the horrific case of Charlotte Dawson in Australia, who was being trolled and constantly she obviously had other issues and this was on top of those, and constantly looking at those comments. There's a point where, yes, you want to know what's going on, but there's a point where it's really unhelpful to keep looking at those.
And how about in terms of advice for people just to stay safe online and hopefully avoid getting into this situation before it even starts? Are there techniques that you could recommend, or is it just one of those things, the internet's so vast, see what you can do?
I think that there are to some extent, but there's the, I can't believe I'm saying, old adage of, don't poke the bear, but don't feed the trolls. But those kind of things are stuff that you can do to avoid that. When you know, or at the point you realise that somebody is there to argue with you, then not pushing back, ending those conversations, doing that block, unfollow, or flagging, all of those kind of responses are useful. But the truth is that, for a lot of people, the worst situations are the ones where people who, up until that point, have been, trusted confidants, have been friends, have been life partners, boyfriends, girlfriends, husbands, wives, and very hard to protect yourself against an attack from someone who has been as close to you up until that point. I mean, I think the best way to protect yourself in those circumstances is understand what your rights are, understand what your options are, and understand what those technological solutions are, but also understand that when things get out of your ability to deal with them, either technologically or emotionally, that there are other places and other people that can provide that help and support. Now, that they may well be people within your own existing networks. That, you know, we know from research that the first place that most young people go when they experience these things are their friends. Peers are the most important actor in successful resolution for young people who are being harassed online. But when those peers run out of ideas, or if you can't talk to those people about it because of the nature of the situation, then finding other help services that can support you is also a vital avenue. And like I say, knowing, you know, it's all very well for us all to say, and you need to be able to block them. But if it comes down to it, and it takes you several days and to work out how to do that blocking, then the effect of it is minimized. So making sure you're familiar ahead of time.
Just one final thing I'd like to say is that just everyone who's online, I think it's really important to, if you're posting something, just reread how could it be taken, how could someone read that, and what is the effect going to be, and do you really want to say it? I think that's the most important thing, is just taking that first step to be positive online, because the more people that are positive, the less people are going to want to go against the flow maybe and be negative. So yeah, maybe.
George, any final comments?
I was going to completely agree, and that sort of prevention is almost the best case scenario. Be really aware of the impact of what you're about to do is going to have, either on yourself in terms of maybe pictures or videos for the future, or on someone else.
Well, that's an excellent point to finish up. And as always, basically, I feel like we end this show saying, you know, speak up, share your story if you feel it might help, which is, after all, why we are called Speak Up Quaderotia. So I'd like to thank you all very much for coming in, sharing your valuable insights and such a variety of perspectives, which is really cool when we come to having these sorts of discussions.
Pleasure. Cool. Thank you.
Thank you, Ora.
Thank you. Our pleasure.